Shrink Wrap Radio number 582, Memoir of a Trans Therapist with Adam Crabtree.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Today, my return guest is Adam Crabtree, psychotherapist and author of the book Memoir of a Trans Therapist, Hypnosis and the Evolution of Human Potentials, which will be the focus of our interview. He was previously my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio number 576, speaking about his 2017 book, Evolutionary Love and the Ravages of Greed. For more information about Adam Crabtree, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Adam Crabtree, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, it's good to be back.
Well, we had a great conversation. It was about in November of last year when we spoke about your book on evolutionary love, and I discovered that we had so much in common. We both had a background in humanistic psychology and a strong interest in clinical hypnosis, and I suggested let's have another conversation down the road about your experiences in clinical hypnosis and about the book that you've written, which I want people to see here, called Memoir of a Trans Therapist. And it's so perfect because it's got you in a priest's cassock, yeah. Monk's cassock, right?
Yeah. It's actually a hoodie, but yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of, is it really? It's a whimsical cover in a way. And, you know,
by my sister.
You've got such a fascinating background that informs all of your work, your writing, and your clinical work. You were a Catholic priest in the Benedictine order, as I understand. Is the correct tense were, or are you still in that?
That's past. I left that in the late 60s.
Okay.
Both of those things, yes.
Okay. That might make for an interesting story right there. Should I ask you about it or not?
Well, it's interesting from the point of view of what we're talking about, in that I was not in psychotherapy at that time. But when I came to Toronto to study as a priest, to study philosophy, I went into psychotherapy, and that began my career interest in psychotherapy and eventually working as a psychotherapist.
Yeah, and you also, you're a philosopher and a historian and a psychoanalyst as well, right? Again, for a while.
I was trained in psychoanalysis. I would say that my psychotherapy is more general and called more fittingly probably psychodynamic psychotherapy, which is broader than just psychoanalysis.
Right, right. But that's a lot of hats to wear that you've had in the past, and you bring all of that sort of rich perspective to your work.
Yes.
Now, in your book, Memoir of a Trans Therapist, you say that there had been no solid definition of hypnosis at that time, and so that sent you off doing a literature search.
And, that's right.
And you came up with your own definition. I was sort of shocked to hear that there was no solid definition, because people have been talking about writing about hypnosis ever since Mesmer's time.
Yes, they had been. Well, what I had to do was go back, first of all, to Mesmer, because if I was going to get to the bottom of hypnosis and its use in psychotherapy, that was the beginning, Franz Anton Mesmer.
Yeah.
And especially then his pupil, who was the Marquis de Puységur.
Yes.
So when I went back there, I discovered that, and then traced the history from there up to the present time, that there's never been an agreed upon definition of hypnosis. And I found that very troublesome, because if you're going to write a book about hypnosis, which is what I was trying to do, I didn't have a good solid starting point to start with, agreed upon definition. Mm. So I began looking into that problem, and decided that if I was going to talk about something that covered all the phenomena of hypnosis and animal magnetism that have been listed over all those years, from about 200 years, there are hundreds of them.
Yeah.
And I had to come up with a definition that could cover them all. Otherwise, it was not going to work.
Right.
And so what I settled on was the notion of trance. Trance is the older word. Mm-hmm. Trance is the broader word. And it actually, I gave trance a definition that covers all the hypnotic and animal magnetic phenomena of those years.
That's interesting, because trance was sort of the older term for a long time. And,
yes.
then I think it sort of went out of fashion to talk about trance, and now it seems to be coming back in.
Yes, well, the person who continued to talk about it all the years when it wasn't used very much was Milton Erickson. And of course, he's a very influential guy.
Right.
So when I saw that he used the word trance, that gave me a lot of confidence about going ahead in that direction.
Yeah, you had permission in a sense. Yep. And so you came up with a very interesting definition, which I'll read here. Your definition is trance as a state of inner mind focus that involves rapport with the hypnotizer.
Now, that's the definition of hypnosis.
Okay.
There's a broader definition of trance that I maybe should give you.
Okay.
The broader definition of trance is a state of focus on something, anything,
yes,
with a diminished awareness of everything else that evokes a latent subliminal resources that we have within us to deal with whatever we're focused on. That's a very broad definition, mm-hmm, of trance. And that will cover all of the phenomenon of those 200-year history, of that 200-year history that we have to account for.
So that really brings in the idea of absorption that,
yes, exactly.
I'm thinking of a Csikszentmihalyi and
yes,
and what his work now I'm blocking on
flow.
Exactly. Yeah, flow. So it sounds very much like flow, but with this additional dimension of access to resources, inner
exactly
resources.
And this is very important from how I will use it, not only in my psychotherapy work, but also in understanding the development of human potentials.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to talk about that a bit later, too, if we could.
Oh, yeah. I'm very interested in that, in human potential. One of the things I stumbled over in your definition of hypnosis was inner mind focus. And
yes,
I sort of went, well, inner mind as opposed to what? Is there an outer mind?
Yes. You see, when I was defining trance, I divided it up sort of arbitrarily into four different kinds of trance. That is, four different areas that we can focus on.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, there's situational trance. What we're focused on is a situation, a task, something that is we're doing. And what we're focused on is that, and the resources that are called upon are whatever we need to do that task to be involved with this external practical matter.
Okay.
I call that a situational trance. Then there's an interpersonal trance, where what we're focused on is another person and our relationship with that person, interpersonal. And what the resources are that are called forward in us are everything that's involved in that that interaction with that person. And often that's going to be very deep kinds of resources, feelings, deep communication, and so forth. But then there is inner mind trance. And what we're focused on there is the inner world, that is, the world where things come to us, come into our awareness on the from the inside.
Okay.
Everything that arises from the subconscious or the unconscious aspect of ourselves and comes into our awareness when we close our eyes and go inside. That's the inner world, and the inner mind trance is the focus on that inner world in order to carry out any task. For instance, to do a therapeutic task,
mm-hmm,
with the inner world and with whatever comes to us in that from that inner world. And then the fourth kind is group mind trance, and that's probably the most surprising designation, and that is the focus is on the group thinking that we are involved in, whether that's a family or a staff or a church or a culture. We're involved in many different kinds of groups, and we become focused on that way of thinking while the group influence is upon us. And I call that group mind trance. And what we bring forward then as resources are whatever we need to be a part of that group and promote that interaction with the group.
Okay. So the first one was the situational trance, right?
Yeah.
So that might be something like playing the piano.
Yes.
If you were completely absorbed in it.
That's right. Or writing a book.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Or dancing on a stage, performing.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a situational trance also.
Yeah, yeah.
Or threading a needle. Because there you have to focus very finely, and you use this fine muscle resources that you develop in order to get that thread through the needle.
Yeah.
So you can see that these are part of everyday life. In other words, we're always focusing on something and bringing forward the resources we need to deal with that focus.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure we're going to be talking about these four as we go along. They'll crop up in one way or another. Going back to your definition of hypnosis, there's the second part of it emphasizes rapport with a hypnotizer. So that made me want to ask you, well, what about self-hypnosis?
Yes. With hypnosis, I define as an inner mind trance where we're exploring that inner mind, as I mentioned in a moment ago. And it also involves rapport or a special connection with the hypnotizer or the person who is putting us into this trance state. And that is an important distinction that one sees between hypnosis and meditation, because in meditation, there isn't the rapport aspect. Now, if you have self-hypnosis, there, how does one explain that there is a rapport with self-hypnosis?
Right.
And the only way that I've been able to make sense out of that is to say that we are in rapport with whoever it was that has been working with us hypnotically. In our mind, in our memory, we go back to that and set up that kind of rapport.
Or it might also be closer to meditation. For example, I might have read about self-hypnosis in a book and never had that interaction with a hypnotist.
Exactly. That's right. And in that case, my definition would be that's not actually hypnosis, even though we might call it self-hypnosis. Meditation would be a more accurate way of talking about that.
Okay. I was interested in your discussion of post-hypnotic amnesia as an instance of state-specific memory. There are all these phenomena, and you go over a lot of the sort of well-known phenomena related to hypnosis, and some are particularly dramatic, and post-hypnotic amnesia is particularly dramatic, I think.
It is.
And
it is.
You linked it to more recent research on state-specific memory. So take us through that.
Yes, that's right. When I was doing heavy work on the history of hypnosis and animal magnetism, you saw right at the beginning where the Marquis de Puységur was developing his psychological approach to animal magnetism, that he said that it was inevitable that when he put a person into this state of deep, what he called magnetic sleep or this deep trance, when they came back out of that state, they could never remember what had occurred during that state. There was always post-magnetic sleep amnesia. And he said no matter how he tried to get them to remember, he could not get them to remember. Now, what's interesting is that over the two centuries since his first work, post-hypnotic or post-magnetic or whatever you want to call it, amnesia or post-trance amnesia is more probably appropriate, has become less and less a part of it. In other words, at that time, virtually everyone had post-trance amnesia. Today, it's about 1/10 or 10% of people who have post-trance amnesia. And I think that that's an important thing to know, because when you're working as a therapist, you're not ordinarily going to get that kind of amnesia at the end of a session, but you may, or you may get a degree of amnesia at the end of a session. Now, to explain that amnesia. I came across these articles on state-related memory, and what that the principle involved in state-related memory is that when you learn something or you experience something in one state, you will remember it best if you can go back to that state later on, that very same state, and you'll have the best recall. For instance, if a person is, let's say, at a party, they're drinking, not driving, but they're drinking, and so they're in a high state from drinking, and then they put their keys somewhere, and they can't find their keys. They look all over, they can't find their keys the next day, and they can't get the memory back where they put them. They find that if a person will then drink again and go back into that same state of intoxication, they will be able to remember where they put the keys, much more likely, because that state brings along with it the memory of everything that has occurred in previous states of the same kind. And that's what's called state-specific or state-related memory. Now with trance, in the old days, when it first began, the state of being awake or in the normal state, like with the first subjects, was so different from their state of trance that they couldn't bridge that gap without going back into the trance again. When they went back into the trance, they could remember everything. But when they came out, they could remember nothing. Now, over the two centuries since that early time, we've become much more psychologically sophisticated, which means that the state is not as, the distance between the two states is not as great, and the bridge between the two states is easier to make because we are more psychologically thinking these days than they were back to 200 years ago.
Yeah, this reminds me, too, of hysteria during Freud's time.
Yes.
And it seemed like there were just tons of people suffering from hysterical phenomena, such as a hysterical paralysis or anesthesias, all kinds of weird phenomena.
Yes.
That we don't see today. And the explanation that's generally given is that those people were psychologically unsophisticated, and particularly around issues of sexuality, since a lot of those phenomena Freud discovered seemed to be related to repressed sexuality.
Yes.
So it's a similar kind of thing, that there was a cultural, both involve a cultural state of relative ignorance, if you will.
This is true. And those people that the Genet studied, who were the typical hysterics of the at the time, were certainly going into trance states. And those trance states would be different trance states that one person would have. And some of the time that amounted to multiple personality. So that each one of those personalities was a different trance state, or I should say more accurately, a different trance cluster. A cluster of trances in this personality, a different cluster of trances in this one, etc.
That's another phenomenon that when I was in graduate school, I was told that I would never encounter someone with multiple personality, that it was that rare. However, now there are just lots of people who profess to experience multiple personalities. I would have students when I was teaching come up and say with some pride that they were a multiple.
Yes.
Yeah. What's your thinking about that?
Well, I went through the whole gamut of that. I was working with multiple personality back in the late 1980s.
Okay.
And I wrote about it actually in my first book, Multiple Man, called Explorations in Multiple Personality and Possession. And at that time, it was a new thing, and there was a lot of skepticism about it. This is the mid-80s. And as the 80s went on, there were more and more cases showing themselves because there was more publication about it, more awareness, and more diagnosis of it. So that by the time we reached, let's say, the early 1990s, there were many cases being reported. And in my own work, I would say between 1986 and let's say 2000, I probably worked with 40 people who had multiple personality disorder, or what is called dissociative identity disorder today, mm-hmm. on the extreme end of the spectrum.
Yeah.
So, yes, there were many then, but in the mid-90s, the whole false memory syndrome issue came up.
Right.
And it made a lot of therapists frightened to work with multiple personality disorder, to work with recovered memory, because therapists were starting to get sued for doing that kind of work. Because there was a kind of a panic, or I would say there was a sort of a huge misunderstanding of both the nature of multiple personality or dissociative disorders and the nature of therapeutic work. They thought this was being created in the therapy in some cases. And so therapists started to avoid working with these cases. And I think that people who were experiencing multiple personality disorder kind of went underground. They didn't feel very safe in talking about it anymore because it was being ridiculed from about 1993 on, when Elizabeth Loftus started talking about the problems of memory.
Yes.
So there was a definite dip in the manifestation of multiple personality disorder, I would say, until the early 2000s.
Somehow this seems to me to maybe relate to your idea of cultural trance, that depending upon what's going on in the culture, people may be more experiencing more of something or less, depending upon the cultural ideas about it and the information that's abroad about it. So that there were no multiple personalities for a period that we knew of.
Yes.
And then it kind of, you know, I think maybe we do see what some people would label fads in diagnostic categories and maybe the experiences that people have.
There's no question about it, except the word fad is not the best.
Very pejorative.
I know you don't mean it that way, but sometimes people sort of dismiss it from that mm-hmm. point. It's actually a much more serious and important phenomenon, and that is the social dimension of psychological disorders. There's a definite social dimension, mm-hmm. and symptoms that show themselves are to a degree dependent upon what society around them expects or is ready to be able to receive as a symptom. And that's why, for instance, hysteria was so common in the 1890s, and now other kinds of disorders are more common, and hysteria isn't as common. I think it's partly because of this social dimension of the manifestation of psychological disorders.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of framing it. I like that, the kind of the social surround has an impact.
Yes, it really does.
Yeah.
Well, I talk about this in my book, From Mesmer to Freud, that before Puységur made his discoveries about the unconscious, and he opened up that whole thing as a possible explanation for the reason that people do things that they can't account for, before that, the definition or the explanation for people doing things they can't account for and don't like to do was possession.
Mm-hmm.
After that, people started being able to explain them carrying on these things from the point of view of having an unconscious,
yes.
which was affecting them.
Yeah.
And so it was only after Puységur that you see historically manifestations of multiple personality disorder. Before that, it's only possession.
Right.
Now, that's an example, in my mind, of the social dimension of the symptoms of a disorder.
Yeah. There's a story that I remember about, attributed to that time with Puységur, that he magnetized a tree on his property.
Yes.
And that he had and maybe a crowd of people around who had seen him do that, and that he had a serving boy who went up and touched the tree and immediately fell into what looked like a trance.
Yes.
And that boy then also had some miraculous sounding abilities to diagnose illnesses and so on. Yeah. Have you encountered that story as well, and what do you make of it?
Yeah. Well, when Puigseguir puts the first person, who was a young man called Victor,
yes,
into magnetic sleep, he did have what seemed to be telepathic abilities. That is, when Puigseguir was trying to cure him of what we would call the flu today. And so he had a fever, and he wanted to get the young man to dance to work off the fever. He thought if sweating would help with the fever. So he hummed some tunes and got the guy who was suggestible to start dancing, which he did. But he found after a while that he could just think about a tune, and no matter which tune he was thinking about, Victor would hum it, even though he was only thinking about the tune.
Yeah.
That was one manifestation. Another manifestation of something extraordinary in Victor and in many people at that time was the ability to diagnose their own illnesses and prescribe effective remedies. And Victor did that, as did other people who were put into the state of magnetic sleep similar to Victor.
So what's your thinking about that? I mean, we don't see that sort of thing very much these days, and it's kind of off in its own little corner, if you will, of people who claim to have that sort of ability. Where do you come out with that?
Well, in my own attitude towards it is, if there is good reason to accept the phenomena, that is the facts, without necessarily accepting the explanation or having to have an explanation, then I'm ready to accept whatever facts show themselves. Mm-hmm. If in fact, let's say somebody comes up in that state with a remedy that immediately very much improves the person in their condition, well, maybe there is some unconscious native ability to know something about nature and natural remedies that this person gets in touch with. That's a possible explanation. I just think that some of these unusual things did indeed happen. And even though there may be many different explanations for them, we should not dismiss them just because we can't put them into an explanation that's familiar to us.
Yeah, I'm thinking of Edgar Cayce, who also reportedly came upon those sorts of abilities also in relation to hypnosis.
That's right, he did.
Yeah.
So and
reportedly, his work has been studied extensively and been verified.
Yes, it has. And this is this sort of, I don't know if we're ready to go in this direction, but this is definitely connected to what I see as the connection between trance states and the human potential movement, the development of human potentials.
Well, let's go there since it's come up right now.
Right. Okay. Well, you see, the way I see the history of things from the time of Mesmer to today, the Puigseguir particularly started a kind of human potential movement, without calling it that at the time. Mm-hmm. He developed this magnetic sleep, which actually, for some people, not only cured them, but in some cases gave them abilities or revealed abilities that were surprising. And those abilities were developed because they would go into the trance state, the deep trance state, or what he called magnetic sleep. Now, the human potential movement that occurred in the 1960s and 70s, here particularly named, I think it was around the Esalen group, as the human potential movement, I think was also in every way related to trances, because if you look at the various techniques that were used, drumming, dancing, various kinds of exploration of the unconscious through going into altered states, perhaps drug-induced altered states, but in all of these cases where extraordinary things happen to people, there was some technique of trance, some technique where a person was getting a focus through some, let's say, whether it was dancing or drugs or something else, and that focus then would allow something to come forward from them, which was surprising.
You've just given me a new idea here. I'm thinking of Werner Erhard's EST training.
Yes.
And which was very popular for a time. And one of the probably the main component of it was sleep deprivation with a charismatic leader, and that I think induced some kind of altered state of consciousness.
I have no doubt.
Yeah.
No doubt. And the people became very suggestible. And remember, particularly in groups, people are more suggestible than when individually is affected. And so those were highly charged and highly effective ways of putting people in a suggestible state. The problem with that particular movement, in my own opinion, is that it wouldn't last, because it depended upon the renewal of that over and over again. And people who dropped away from those things usually had second thoughts about what they had discovered or believed they discovered in that situation.
Yeah. Yeah. What about another phenomenon that's associated with of the controversial phenomena associated with hypnosis or trance has to do with age regression? And maybe you've done work, and feel free to throw in clinical examples from your own experience as we go along here.
Yes. Well, age regression, I tell you, that's something that Milton Erickson did a lot of. I don't do a lot of age regression. It's much more the focus on reclaiming memory or reclaiming early perspectives that the person has as they're growing up. And so that certainly involves trance work, and I can give you examples of that. I can't give you very good examples of age regression because I just don't usually approach things that way.
Mm-hmm.
But with regard to going back and remembering things, not only remembering events, but also remembering perspectives that you have when you're a little child in certain situations, which perspectives remain with you very powerfully on unconscious levels and can affect you as an adult without realizing how much you're being affected by that. To get to those things, I find that trance states in psychotherapy, what I would call therapeutic trances, are highly effective. They are inner mind trances where you help a person go into their inner world and pay attention to what comes forward in the form of images, memories, impressions, symbols, whatever it may be. And those things, and also, by the way, dreams and analyzing dreams, those things can lead to very fruitful uncoverings of those early perspectives that are still within the person and affecting them in, let's say, problematic ways. So a woman, for instance, who I worked with, who's having difficulty with men, knew it somehow was related to her relationship with her father, but she didn't really know how. She just had a sense that that was why she was having trouble relating to men. In the therapeutic trance state, she clearly saw the despotic nature of her father. She hadn't really seen it before, or hadn't been able to admit it to herself consciously before. But that became very clear to her in that state. And also it became clear to her how it affected her, how she felt when she was a small girl, when she was a little older and so forth, through the stages of growing and developing. And she could see those things and experience those things in the trance state in a way that she could never do just in her ordinary state through conversation or discussing those things with the therapist.
Yeah, you know, I've been preparing for an upcoming interview having to do with Freud and psychoanalysis and the use of the couch. And I've long been of the opinion that the couch, you know, some people have dismissed it as, oh, he just didn't like to look people in the eye. That the couch induces an altered state of consciousness, which is kind of what we're talking about. And so so that there was trance involved without the hypnotic patter, if you will.
Oh, I agree completely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. You see, I know that early, you're right, Freud put aside the notion of using hypnosis in therapy, but he was using trances.
Yes, right.
And couch, it would make sense to me that the couch became a stimulus to a trance state.
Yeah, and And that's where, just as you were describing, this woman's memories of her father began to emerge in the hypnotic trance. So too on the couch, people were encouraged to let images from the past bubble up.
Yes.
And not to judge them, you know, as...
That's right.
Yeah.
That's so important, not to judge them.
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you about work that I use trance for in training psychotherapists here in Toronto. One of our courses is a dream seminar.
Great.
Dream seminar, we ask the person, one of the members of the group, the students, to bring in a dream. And everybody, I put everybody into a trance state.
Mm.
While the person is reading the dream, they allow themselves to move into that inner theater, the inner world that I was talking about, and just notice whatever impressions come to them, no matter how irrelevant they may seem. Just pay attention to them, and then at the end, when we start to talk about the dream, to remember them and to bring them forward and not worry about whether they make sense, not worry about analysis, but rather consider the fact that we all communicate on an unconscious level very powerfully. And if when you're in that inner mind trance, you get in touch with some of that information coming through the unconscious mind, and you're in touch with the person who has the dream on that level too. And so when you bring your images to the group situation, you're actually bringing something that's relevant. It's not a guess. It's not analysis. It's actually some kind of a direct access.
Yeah, I've in doing some group work with dreams with undergraduate students over the years, I would be amazed sometimes that one student might just come up with something that sounds like really just weird and out of the blue in responding to somebody's dream. And the dreamer says, oh my God, that's it. You've got
that's
it exactly right.
That's right. That happens all the time in this kind of group.
Yeah. So probably some people are wondering, well, what's the process that you use? You say you put the group into a trance. What's the process for that?
Well, the process, once you have a definition of trance, then trance inductions are easy as pie. If you don't know what trance is, then you have to use sort of the inductions that have worked over the ages. Do you know what I mean? Somehow this induction works, that one induction works. But if you know what it is, then any road to the source or to where you're going, whatever the trance is a valid induction. So let me give you an example. If I'm working with someone and that person comes in on some morning, they've been having an argument with their partner. So they come in and they sit down and they're all upset about this. They're still involved with the issue and it hasn't been resolved. And they can't think about anything else but this argument that's just happened. Well, some people would say, well, and I would say, well, I want to use trance with this person to help them understand what's going on. Some people would say, how can you put them in a trance when they're fit to be tied? How can you get them to relax enough? How can you get them to do that? And it's so simple. All you do is you say to the person, well, now please close your eyes and remember the argument that you were in and let it come vividly into your mind. Let yourself feel the feelings and go right back there and see your partner in front of you and so forth. And they are immediately in a very deep inner mind trance.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else disappears and they're completely engaged in that. And that's a trance.
Yeah, I like that approach. Now, but in the training group that you were talking about, it's not just the dreamer, but the whole group that you put into a trance. And so how would you do that?
How would I do that? Okay. In this case, I just talk to people about the fact that they all are communicating on an unconscious level, but they just are not aware of it in their ordinary mind. And if they close their eyes now and go into their inner world, that inner theater where images appear and memories come and impressions occur, just go in there and become aware of what's there and start to be aware of anything that may come across that inner awareness. And remember it, note it, and remember it. Don't dismiss anything, no matter how irrelevant it might seem. And as I talk this way, they're going into a trance.
Mm-hmm.
Because getting more and more involved with that inner world. They're looking for the impressions. They're looking for the things that may occur for them in order to be able to later on recall them. So then I will simply count, and this is something Milton Erickson usually did. He counted. I will count like from 1 to 20 and tell them that they'll go more deeply into that inner world as they count. And then when they reach 20, then the dream is read. They have their impressions. Then to bring them back, I simply reverse the count from 20 back to 1 to suggest they'll be back in their ordinary state of awareness at the end of that. So it's a very simple induction.
Okay, fantastic. I wish we had had this conversation years ago. I could have could have brought that into my own work in teaching. Let's see. Was there more that you wanted to say about human potential?
Yes. The 1960s, I remember the 1960s.
I do too.
Okay. Well, you know, there were all kinds of things going on there. Experimentation of every kind, whether it was smoking marijuana or dancing or experimenting with sex and various things. And all of these experiments had some kind of a trance dimension to them. Mm. I mean, when you are involved sexually with someone, everything else disappears pretty well. You are highly focused on that person and the action that's happening between you and that person. It's an interpersonal trance, very deep one. And all kinds of things can happen to people in those states too. So that some found in the years of the human potential movement, when it was at its height, that sexuality itself was a means towards enhanced awareness, enhanced living, mm-hmm. along with drugs that could be used, or as I mentioned, like painting or dancing or even performing. These are all things that could put a person into a trance state, and if they would let whatever would come forward from their inner resources involved with that particular focus, they'd be surprised what would come, and they'd be surprised how it might change them, change their lives.
Yeah. You know, this puts me in mind of a relationship that I had with a woman where it was like we were reading each other's minds for a period there, particularly in the beginning, you know, when the infatuation was at its peak. There would just be amazing correspondences of, I would be thinking about something, and she would just speak it.
Yes.
It was mind-blowing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there you are. You see, this is one thing that I have to say is one of my most profound lessons from working as a psychotherapist, and that is the power of unconscious communication that is constantly going on between people. Most of it is ignored. Impressions come to you, an image comes to you, and so forth. And you just say, oh, that's ridiculous, and you go on. You forget you had it. And most of the time, there's something anything that comes completely out of the blue, most likely there's something important there. Mm-hmm. It's a beginning of some kind of a revelation that can take place if you follow it.
Yeah, to give you a more specific example from the relationship I just referred to, we're at the very beginning of this relationship, and this is sort of a hippie young woman, and I'm wondering, you know, well, is this sort of hippie presentation all there is here? You know, might she ever look otherwise? And she speaks up and says, I can get really dressed up, you know. So, I'll never forget that. And of course, people can cultivate, and that's what the whole human potential movement was about. Some people are drawn to cultivate these things in themselves, to find ways that fit for them to create an altered state of consciousness, whether it be dancing or drumming or chanting or meditating. Yes. Or whatever. And right now there's a large interest in shamanism, and I think that relates a lot to what you've been saying, what we're talking about here.
Well, no doubt about it. Shamans certainly go into trance states all the time. That's part of their repertoire. Yeah. Let me give you a very trivial example on the other end of the scale. of something that's striking precisely because it's so trivial. Okay. This is a situation where I was in a subway station here in Toronto, where I live, and I was coming to the stairs going down to the platform where the subways come in below. And when I got to the top of the stairs, this song came into my mind called Now Is the Hour. Now, I don't know if you knew that song, but when I was growing up, the kids were singing it on the buses when you're going to games and stuff like that. It goes, now is the hour when we must say goodbye. Soon you'll be sailing far across the sea. While you're away, oh, then remember me. Those are the lyrics.
Okay.
So the song came to my mind out of nowhere, and I thought, this is ridiculous. What's this? So I was going down the stairs, and I couldn't get rid of the song from my mind. And I felt forced to start singing it mentally. So I was going down the stairs and singing, now is the hour when we must say goodbye. Soon you'll be sailing far across the sea. While you're away, and when I came to the line, while you're away, I stepped onto the platform below, and I looked up at an advertising sign, one of these signs that we used to have. The message was moving across with these red beads, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just all kinds of advertising. And when I looked up, the line going across was, while you're away.
Wow.
The very moment I was singing that particular song. Now, that's as trivial as you can get. Like, so what? Do you know what I mean?
That's what I would call a synchronicity.
It's a synchronicity.
Yeah.
That's right. The subject matter is trivial, but the experience is very important, very strong. It shows we don't understand how this world is constructed.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't consider that, and I don't consider that accidental or accident anyway. I believe that that's a meaningful thing. The fact that that could happen, and I was forced into the state of concentration. Do you see what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
I was forced into a kind of trance state as I was going down there, forced to sing this song, and it produced this synchronicity by the time I got to the bottom of the stairs.
And I don't know if you carried it further or not, but you could have said, okay, what might this mean for me right now in my life? Where am I away in my life right now, or some variant of that?
You could do that, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, I did make a connection for myself personally, and it was this. I'm thinking, you think you're so smart? Explain this one. That was a good assignment.
Wait, I didn't hear the second part of that.
You think you're so smart. Explain how this happened.
Oh, okay. Yeah. One of the things that I've noticed that I think just about everybody could use is sometimes I'll catch myself singing a little song in my mind and then ask myself, why am I singing that now? What does that mean? And boy, that's like a direct route to the unconscious.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Because you realize, oh, this is actually commenting on something that, you know, that I'm preoccupied with in my life right now.
Yes, right.
Or need to be preoccupied with.
Yes. I think one of the things I try to help clients that I work with is to pay attention to those kinds of things. Because I can tell you that the vast majority of people don't pay any attention to those things that come to them out of the blue. Those things that they can't explain and just think are nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
If you pay attention to that kind of thing, you learn a great deal about yourself.
Yeah. So what do you see as the evolutionary purpose of what we've been talking about, of trance states?
Well, I think that the whole universe is in the process of evolving, and I think that the human race is in the process of evolving, and that for the human being, since we are thinking creatures, and since we are willing creatures, we partake in our own evolution in ways that other evolving things do not. And I think that we have this special tool, because we are thinking creatures, which is called trance, this tool of focus, which will draw forth from us the next moment of evolution, the next moment which we can move forward with, if we will go with it.
Mm-hmm.
So that I think that that when we move forward in everyday life with our trances, we're also moving forward inch by inch, step by step, on our individual evolutionary paths.
Okay. You know, there was a rather large topic in your book related to asking.
Yes.
And I think that'd be very fruitful for us to discuss here.
Okay. Well, I have a friend who has done a great deal of experimentation with asking. And asking is where you actually ask for something, and you ask a kind of, let's say, some source that could respond to you, even though you don't know what that is, whether you would call it God, whether you would call it the universe, whether you'd call it something in yourself, whatever you may call it, you ask that thing or that person for something that you want, something that you need. And if you do it in a focused and serious way, you will get answers. The Huna approach to spirituality that arose in Hawaii many, many years ago, and mm-hmm. where they practice it yet today, uses asking in precisely that way. They ask the high self for a help, let's say, where they need it, or for healing, or in some cases, ask the high self to allow them to walk across red-hot lava without getting burned, things like that. This is what they would do in Hawaii. Asking was such an important thing. If you ask, that also focuses you. If you ask seriously, you're focusing very much on yourself and whatever, and being in touch with whatever this power is that you are addressing. The Huna approach said, we have three selves. We have our ordinary middle self, which is our everyday practical self. We have the low self, which is more like the subconscious, almost animal-like part of us. And we have a high self, which has powers we can't even imagine. And they believed that was the structure of the human being, and they practiced it in that particular way.
I'm wondering about the phenomenon around the book some years ago, The Secret, which in a sense embodies this idea of mm-hmm. asking for what you want, and yet, in some way, it seemed trivial or got trivialized. What's your take on that phenomenon?
Well, you know, I don't know that book in detail. I really can't comment on that book in detail because I didn't read it.
I didn't either.
No, but I understand from people that I would discuss it with me that it involved some kind of repetitions of asking, some kind of intense over and over again concentration that involved repetitions.
My impression is mostly focused on or at least the way it got popularized, on material gain, on becoming wealthy or famous.
Oh, I see. Yeah, that part of it, yes.
Yeah.
I don't see anything wrong with that. I just think that from what I heard about the approach, I don't know how effective it would be, because people don't usually... Gosh, I hesitate to say this. There is use for repetition. There is use of a kind of repeating, let's say, a prayer or something like that. I don't have any doubt about that. But I think there's something, it can become mechanical and therefore trivial and therefore not effective.
Mm-hmm.
That's about all I can say about that, I think.
Okay. To give you a different kind of example, you know, people talk about putting it out to the universe, which you alluded to, put whatever you're looking for out to the universe. And you've written a number of books. I'm sure you've had the experience of things coming to you almost like magnetized, the various information that you needed, the contacts and the resources.
Yeah.
So I was about to give an example, and then we had a little technical glitch where we got cut off. But the example I wanted to give was one of, quotes, putting it out to the universe, where I had gotten into my head that I had my grandfather's hat, and after he died, and I've kept it all these years. I still have it, and somehow I got it into my head that I wanted it to have a that I wanted it to be sort of my shamanic hat, if you will, and that I wanted to have a rattlesnake hat band. So I'll make the story shorter. I could actually go into a lot more detail. But I was putting it out to various friends. Hey, do you know where I can get a rattlesnake skin to make this hat band? Sometime later, when I wasn't even thinking about that, I came home from one thing or another, and my wife said, hey, Cooch was here, and she left a frozen rattlesnake, and we put it in the freezer for you. And Cooch is a sort of magical tarot reader woman who's the wife of a friend of mine, and she had remembered my telling this story, and she had gone out into her laundry room to wash the flag of the tarot readings that she gives at the Renaissance Fair, and there coiled up in her laundry room was a rattlesnake.
Oh my goodness.
And well, they killed the rattlesnake and they brought it to me. And I have the hat. I should grab it and show it here for people. So that was a personal example, rather striking one for me, of just putting out that intention, sharing it with a rather small circle of people.
Yeah.
And boom, it happened. Wow.
Yes.
Not so much these days. I don't know. I've found that there have been periods in my life where I was maybe more in the flow than it feels like I am now. Do you have any sense of that for yourself or not?
I know that my life is divided into various periods, and I think that in a way this is my most fertile period right now.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of things are coming together. I think we do go through stages which develop, and then we leave behind and go on to another stage which has to develop then in its own particular way.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, well, I would say this has been a fertile stage for me in terms of podcasting. It's come into my life, and I've given myself to it pretty fully, having done more than probably 750 of interviews like this,
yes,
which was not an intention, but it just happened.
Yes.
So this might be a good place for us to wrap it up. I know we've gone about as long as I had indicated that we would. I wonder if there's anything you'd like to say to wrap things up.
Well, just that I do appreciate the opportunity. I enjoy talking about these things.
And
met you and had your interest corresponding with mine in such a way that we can talk about it.
Yeah, right. It's good, and it's reaffirming to share these things. Yeah. So, Adam Crabtree, I want to thank you for being my guest again today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, you're welcome. I enjoyed it.
Well, it was good to be in rapport again with trance therapist Adam Crabtree. From a technical standpoint, I have to say it was not easy. I was all set up to do the interview, but I couldn't seem to get my wireless AirPods to connect. So I tried turning off Bluetooth on my iMac. I then clicked on the button to turn Bluetooth back on, but evidently I didn't wait long enough when I decided to close down my computer and restart it. When it rebooted and asked me to enter my password, I discovered that neither my mouse nor my keyboard would work because both are Bluetooth devices. With the time for our interview ticking by, I called AppleCare and found out that I would need both a wired mouse and a wired keyboard to get back into my computer. I was locked out. I started to panic a bit because my time to connect with Adam was already past, and I couldn't contact him or even phone him because all that information was stored on my computer. Would I have to go buy a corded keyboard and mouse? Fortunately, Adam called me after a bit on the phone, and I was able to explain my dilemma a bit, and doubly fortunately, he could hang around a bit longer than planned while I worked on solving this problem. Then it occurred to me that maybe one of my neighbors would have an older, non-wireless keyboard and mouse. Fortunately, a number of my neighbors tend to be home during the day, and we were on sufficiently good terms that I could approach them to see if they had what I needed. After several tries, one of my neighbors came through. So about an hour later than planned, Adam and I were able to connect online and do the interview. Except that about 5 minutes before we were finished, we lost the connection. More fiddling around, and we got reconnected, and then my challenge was to figure out how to patch the two segments together on both audio and video. Phew! With all my experience and technical expertise, I can't believe I made that mistake with Bluetooth. So I'm happy to be able to have brought you today's interview. Let me say it was good to reconnect with Adam Crabtree. I appreciate both his original turn of mind and the rapport we share, not to mention his patience. If you have any interest or curiosity about trance phenomena, I highly recommend his book. As you could hear in this interview, his interests and perspectives are wide-ranging, and you're guaranteed to have some new thoughts regardless of your level of experience. Finally, if you decide to purchase the book, Memoir of a Trance Therapist by Adam Crabtree, go to the right-hand sidebar on shrinkwrapradio.com and you'll see two book ads from Amazon near the top. Click on either one of them to search for today's book or anything else you might want to purchase from Amazon.com.
Hello, Shrink Wrap Radio friends. My name is Carol Williams, and I'm a huge admirer of Dr. Dave and this podcast. I stumbled upon Shrink Wrap Radio last summer. My introduction, episode number 561, Narcissism and Love, with Jung and analyst Kenneth Kimmel. Needless to say, I was hooked. I am a licensed ready marriage and family therapist associate, growing my specialty in narcissistic abuse and trauma recovery. Since my discovery of this treasure in July, I have listened to every episode available through my iCatcher app and have now happily downloaded Shrink Wrap Radio's app so that I can listen to his earlier interviews. I know I don't have to convince you of the quality of product Dr. Dave is providing to the field of psychology. You've been listening. What I did want to share with you and Dr. Dave is how much I appreciate the care he takes with creating an overall quality product. There's not one part of this podcast that doesn't scream care. From the introductions and summaries, the quality and depth of interview, and even those catchy tunes that always leave a smile on my face. Dr. Dave's warmth has me feel as if I'm a close friend rather than a listener. And at the end of every podcast, I join him in saying, "It's all in your mind." I'd like to ask for you to join me as a financial supporter. While I could tell the email of gratitude I sent Dr. Dave meant a lot, time is of great value, and I wanted to show Dr. Dave how much I appreciate the work he does. As an impoverished intern, I know that financial resources can be tight for many of us. However, even with funds squeezed to their limit, I do find money for those coffee drinks now and then. I decided by becoming a monthly supporter is my way of buying Dr. Dave a cup of coffee to say thank you for all the work you do. While I wish it could be more, I know that if every listener contributed $5 a month, the investment of his work would be validated. So won't you please head over to shrinkwrapradio.com and click on the green support tab? Thank you so much for listening and for considering joining me in keeping this amazing podcast going. And thank you, Dr. Dave, for contributing to my growth as a clinician and as a human being.
Thank you, Carol Williams, for that beautiful endorsement and for encouraging others to follow your fine example as we enter yet another year of podcasting. And I want to say how deeply I appreciate not only Carol's support, but all those of you who have also done so, some of you for years. At the same time, this is the time of year in the U.S. where we have to work on our taxes, which gives me the task of looking at the total listener donations for the year. I'm happy to report that it appears that our listenership has grown. According to the Google app FeedBurner, we have a bit more than 14,000 subscribers to Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm very glad for that. Less heartening is the fact that our total donation income before expenses comes to about one penny per listener for the year. So if you're not currently a donor, won't you please consider becoming one? Look at what you're getting without any cost to you. So far, 582 in-depth interviews with world-class people in and around the broad world of psychology. An archive of all those interviews so that you can go back as far as you wish. Transcripts for about one-third of them by passionate listener volunteers. Access to our monthly newsletter and an app that can put more than 400 of these interviews in your purse or pocket. And my deep gratitude. I did have a guest lined up for last week, but it turned out he was still recovering from the flu. We'll do that interview in a couple of weeks. In the meantime, however, I'm really pleased to report that next week's guest will also be a return guest, just as we had today. It will be Professor Brett Carr, and we'll be discussing his 2017 book, Coffee with Freud. Now, Professor Carr is one of the most preeminent Freud scholars on the planet. He's also one of the most charming and gracious guests I've ever had. And his book really brings Freud to life. I'm very much looking forward to speaking with him again. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
I've been laying on this couch, babe. I've been laying here so long. Just waiting for Dr. Dave, babe, to play his shrink wrap radio song. Oh, he plays it so sweet and he plays it so warm. Shrink wrap radio, it's a harbor from the storm. You know he speaks to your mind, babe, but he's really speaking to your soul. Talking shrink wrap radio, babe. You know that's just the way that he rolls. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, babe, it's all in your mind. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.